Hi, this is Irene Friedman, and the program is...
There's a lot of animals here, Irene. It's all about animals.
Oh, my goodness. We have a cow. See the cow?
Oh, I heard a sheep in there. Oh, the sheep's over there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, in the green pasture.
Oh, yeah. And a lamb. We have a lamb.
Is that Mary over there, Irene?
I think Mary's looking for her lamb. So, yes, it's all about animals, and we have a studio full of animals. Well, coming up today, we have some jokes. And then I'm going to finish the first chapter and tell me where it hurts.
Where does it hurt, Irene?
Well, I guess animals get some pains in their legs by Nick Trout.
Wow, how about that?
He's a veterinarian. And then we have some articles from Dogster and Catster. So let's get started with the jokes.
Let's do that, Irene. I think I've heard of that Trout man. Now, doesn't he like wear? He's like Hugh Hefner with his smoking jacket, I think.
Well, I think he wears a veterinary coat. You know how they wear white coats? My veterinarian wears a white coat with her name embroidered on the pocket.
Oh, yes, they do, Irene. Now, do they wear khakis or trousers?
My veterinarian usually wears like a Dockers type of pants.
There you go.
Okay, let's get started with the jokes.
Let's do that. Oh, you want me to start, Irene?
Yes, that's what I was waiting for.
Okay. Okay, so, well, here's one of my favoritest jokes, Irene.
Do you have animal jokes? Because I didn't find any.
Oh, yes, I think I do. What do you get when you cross a bush and a pig, Irene? What do you get when you... Yeah, this is easy. What do you get when you cross a bush... And a pig.
A bush? You mean like a shrub?
It could be a shrub. I mean, it could be a burning bush, too. I mean, you know. And then it could be very well manicured, too, Irene. I mean, that bush.
Like an Edward Scissorhands.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. But let's see. Bacon and something to do with bacon?
Nope. Now this isn't a burning bush, Irene. Although it's, you know.
A pig in a bush.
Yes. Or a bush in a pig. What do you get when you cross a bush and a pig?
I don't want to just be stuttering and stumbling over guesses. I have no idea.
Okay, what do you get when you cross a bush and a pig? A hedgehog.
Oh! That's very good.
Oh, thank you, Irene.
Okay, well, this is not an animal joke because my Jokopedia has such funny non-animal jokes. So I'm going to take a little break today.
Okay.
Why did the egg accuse the chef of cruelty?
Why did the egg accuse the chef,
Of cruelty?
Why know if it was a fish, he might accuse him of battering the
That's
fish.
That's very good.
We
ought to write that one down about...
Yes.
In our book, yeah.
Yes.
10 years in the making, I think.
I think so, Irene. Okay, it's going to be huge.
Why did the egg accuse the chef of cruelty?
Well, Irene, if I were a chef and I had an egg, I'd probably crack it, Irene. I'd break it. Break it open. Break it open, Irene.
You're on the right track.
I'd scramble it, Irene. I'd be tossing it around and scrambling it.
You're on the right track. He put her in a bowl and beat her.
Okay, Irene. What do you get when you cross a giraffe with a hedgehog, Irene? What do you get when you cross a giraffe with... Now, like I say, these are like real easy.
What
do you get when you cross a giraffe with a hedgehog?
Something about a long neck.
Yeah, it's long, Irene.
I don't know much about hedgehogs.
You don't?
No.
You want to look them up real quick, Irene?
I don't think we have time.
Oh, I don't think we do.
Giraffe and a hedgehog.
Giraffe and a hedgehog.
I know they kind of scurry under the, you know.
What do they look like, Irene?
I thought they looked like little, like almost like porcupines.
Yeah, I think so, Irene. So what do you get when you put the two together? Because you're crossing them. I mean, basically, you're putting them together.
A tall pine.
Nope. Well, you might. You
know. I don't know.
Okay, what do you get when you cross a giraffe with a hedgehog? A 6-foot toothbrush, Irene.
Oh, God. These are difficult. These are really hard.
Well, Irene, you said you wanted them hard.
No, I like easy.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought they were, but
okay.
Apparently they're not.
Well, you're an economical type of person. Where can you get four?
Are you calling me cheap?
No,
okay.
But I know you're thrifty.
Okay.
How can you get 4 suits for a dollar?
How can you get 4 suits for a dollar?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get 4 suits for a dollar? Well, they call a dollar a buck. You make them out of a deer.
No.
Nope, that'd be a one. That'd be a buck. Okay, so what was that again?
How can you get 4 suits for a dollar?
I don't think you can, Irene. But then you're going to ask why, and I have no answer. How do you get 4 suits for a dollar? 4 suits for a dollar. 4 suits for a dollar. 4 suits? You buy a deck of cards, Irene.
Oh, you got it. You got to buy a deck of cards. Oh, I didn't think you were going to get it.
Okay, Irene, what do you get when a snake and a hedgehog mate, Irene? What do you get when a snake and a hedgehog mate?
I guess history would be made.
Yes, it would, wouldn't it? But no, that's not what I'm looking for.
Snake.
Yes.
A wiggly piggly?
No.
Piggly Wiggly?
Ooh, that's kind of funny. We ought to put that in our book.
Okay. These are difficult. And I want it easy.
Well, we'll get you easy next week.
Okay. I think if I knew more about hedgehogs, I'd be better at these.
Yes, Irene. I think I would, too. I'd get the jokes better, but I think this is going to be pretty good.
Give me the
answer. I think they do have the hair that's prickly.
Okay. Well, give me the answer.
What do you get when a snake and a hedgehog mate? 2 yards of barbed wire.
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know who your source is, but these are very clever, and I think they were made for someone whose intellect is higher than mine.
Yeah, mine too, Irene. That's why I just read them.
Okay. Well, we have one more joke for you.
Okay.
Why did the woman divorce the grape?
Why did the woman
divorce the grape?
The grape.
I guess we're talking about a female grape divorcing the grape husband.
Okay, so what was the question?
Why did the woman divorce the grape?
Well, Irene, I've got my answer here, but it's not much of an answer.
Let's have it.
Because he was always trying to get her drunk because he's a grape and he was probably fermenting.
No.
No.
But that's cute.
Yeah. Gosh, Irene, because he was always whining when he was stepped on.
No.
I think I'm going to have to give up on that, Irene.
Because why did the woman divorce the grape? Because she was tired of raising kids. You like that, huh?
That was pretty good, Irene.
Yeah, that was pretty good. Well, I can't take credit for it. It came from Jokelopedia.
Ooh, well, that's a good source there, Irene.
Well, you know what?
What, Irene?
That has ended. We've done 3 jokes each. So I think that will end the joke segment of the program because I want to get on to Dr. Trout and tell me where it hurts.
There you go. I could almost tell you, but bye-bye, Irene.
Bye. Thank you so much for joining us today. Okay, as I explained in this book, the chapters are pretty long. So this is, I think, the 3rd week of reading chapter 1, and Dr. Trout has been called to the emergency clinic because the new veterinarian, female veterinarian, is not capable, or she doesn't feel she's capable of how to treat this poor dog with a bloated stomach. And if they can't take care of the situation, the dog is going to die. Okay, let me backtrack a little bit. So they were able to get the bloat out of the dog's stomach. And thanks, says Dr. Keene. I mean, like, for making me keep going, because she didn't think she could do it. Not a problem, I reply. It's like I always say, surgery is meant to be difficult, but the more you struggle, the more you learn. Her professionally plucked eyebrows knit over her mask in an expression that says, okay, Grandpa, no need to get all philosophical on me. She recovers and says, so now what? My hands begin fishing through the blood and small intestines. Time to check out Mr. Spleen. I locate the large, meaty boomerang of an organ located adjacent to the stomach. It is entirely purple-black in color. What do you think, I ask. Dr. Keene does exactly as I had hoped, feeling for the arterial supply to the spleen and palpating for a pulse between her fingers. She takes her time moving from one vessel to the next before concluding, nothing. I feel no pulses. The spleen is dead. I repeat her examination for myself and agree with her conclusion. Unfortunately, the spleen is tightly tethered to the stomach, so wherever the stomach goes, the spleen must try to follow. In the case of a GDV, the result can be damage and obstruction to the spleen's blood flow, followed by the organ's death. Fortunately, Sage can afford to lose her spleen. Dan, I'll take an LDS. Dr. Keene smiles behind her mask at the mention of another three-letter acronym. It is contagious, and for a second, as we wait for the instrument, I bask in the memory of those early days as a surgical resident, where everything was new and every sterile instrument was like opening a present at Christmas. LDS stands for ligation and divide stapler, a surgical device that loops and handles a little bit like a gun and has a barrel cartridge, a grip, and a trigger which fires metal clips that seal off a blood vessel, just before a razor-sharp blade slices the vessel in two. It also comes powered by a carbon dioxide gas canister so that each shot makes a satisfying noise like a sound suppressor on a handgun. I don't care whether it is soft tissue surgery or orthopedics. Surgeons love toys. In minutes, with instrument and semi-automatic fire in her hands, I feed Dr. Keene the appropriate vessels, and the dead spleen is out of Sage's body. Okay, I say, now let's go back to the stomach and see how it looks. Her hand sweeps back a stray loop of bowel. I grab at the main body of the stomach, pulling it free of the blood into the bright light of the surgical lamps. Dr. Keene senses my hesitation. What is it? For a moment, I say nothing, taking my time, changing the position of my hands, feeling the tissue as it slips between my fingers. Noting its color and its texture, I can almost feel Mr. Hartman's hand on my shoulder. I don't like what I see. This area. I point to the junction of the stomach and the esophagus. Its color, that purple congestion with maybe a hint of gray, it might not be viable. Dr. Keene is staring at me. So why not simply staple it off? She makes her question feel like a casual invitation, one I can take or leave. I wish it were that simple. Dogs and cats don't read textbooks in which line drawings, flowcharts, and photographs reduce disease to black and white. Surgery is replete with everything in between, forcing surgeons to make quick, vital decisions based on experience, instinct, and faith. Mistakes are inevitable, and the results are indelible. In my opinion, dexterity and touch can take a surgeon only so far. Learning to make the right decision is the art in this science. I like to believe that my decision is objective, emotionally detached from patient and client alike. But in my peripheral vision, I can see a dog who still manages to say hello with a stomach about to burst, and an old man reduced to tears at the thought of losing his closest friend. If this job came with tunnel vision, her clinical judgment would be so much clearer. Here are Sage's three options as I see them. I say, one, we take our chance to staple off as much stomach as we dare and pray that nothing breaks down. Dr. Keene nods her approval. Two, we seal off the end of the esophagus, seal off the end of the stomach, put a feeding tube into her small intestine, put a tube into Sage's throat and down her esophagus to suck off her own saliva because it has nowhere else to go, let the stomach decide whether it lives or dies, and come back in a few days to see if we can put her back together again. Wow, she says, her eyebrows performing a fine impersonation of the golden arches. Have you ever tried to do that? No, I said, and I hope I never will, but in theory it is possible. I just don't know if I should put an animal through all that surgery when the risk of failure is so high. She appears relieved. So, what's option three? I sigh. We call it a day. I scrub out and speak to Dr. Hartman right now, explain her predicament. It might be better to let Sage die in her sleep than to have to wake her up and succumb to a slow and painful death when her stomach perforates because I made the wrong decision. Suddenly, I notice a beat of the heart monitor filling the silence, and it sounds deafening. What do you think Mr. Hartman will want to do? I meet her stare. I know the answer. The right thing, whatever that may be. For a full minute, neither of us speaks. My relationship with animal and owner is entirely superficial and only minutes old, yet I hold two lives in the balance, one physically and one emotionally. Who am I to make the call? Dan, give me a GIA, and I'm going to need at least 3 or 4 cartridges. I read agreement and relief in Dr. Keene's eyes. The gastrointestinal anastomosis stapler chomps its way across the area of devitalized stomach, sealing and separating the good from the bad as it goes. I let Dr. Keene do most of the work. She may fire the device, but I am the one defining the line of demarcation. I am the one selecting healthy tissue from dead tissue. The responsibility for this part of the procedure is mine alone. Let's oversew the stapler line, I say, and then you can get on with the pexy. Sure, says Dr. Keene, asking Dan for some suture material, but I've only done one before now. Crow's feet gently land at the corners of my eyes. Well, you know what they say, see one, do one, teach one. The resident loads her needle driver and picks up a DeBakey forceps from her table. She tuts, making a nice job of rolling her wrists as she passes the suture through the stomach wall. What idiot made that one up? The term pexy means the surgical fixation of an organ. In this case, a gastropexy is essential to prevent Sage's stomach from performing somersaults in the future. Rather than relying on the strength of synthetic suture material alone to hold the organ in place, a chunky flap of the outer stomach wall is created and fixed to the muscular lining of the abdominal wall for added security. I make Dr. Keene feel for the slip, the physical separation between the inner and outer layers of the stomach, because this is the natural plane she must define, physically separate and exploit. I watch as she traces the margins of the flap with the point of her scissors. I approve her design and let her get to work. In my mind, I am still deliberating over the merits of my gamble. When I hear a curse and look down to see brown fluid spewing from a rent in the stomach lining where Dr. Keene has been cutting with her scissors. I'm so sorry, she says, fumbling with sponges, trying to mop up the contamination flooding her sterile surgical field. I thought I was dissecting in the right place. My scissors went straight into the lumen. It would have been so easy to snatch the instruments from her hands and take over. An arrogant, misogynistic surgeon justified in shooing his resident aside. After all, the last thing my patient needed right now was a case of peritonitis because of her heavy-handed technique. But what would Dr. Keene gain from the experience? How would she learn from her mistake? It's okay, Sarah, it's done. Let's fix the problem. Flush 6 liters of sterile saline through her abdomen. Change gloves, change instruments, and get out. Do you think the mucosa is viable? I peer down at the tiny rip she has made. It is relatively small, and the tissue appears to be healthy. Yes, she says, but without conviction. Look, do you want to finish this? You'll be much faster than me. I shake my head. No way, I say. You need to get used to operating at this time of the morning. Besides, I'm useless before my first cup of coffee. I'd only screw up. Her eyes roll up and say, yeah, right. But her hands are already placing some stay sutures to reduce the risk of further spillage. 15 more minutes, and with the click of the last staple bringing the edges of the skin incision into perfect apposition, I return to the waiting room to speak to Mr. Hartman. He is still sitting where I first saw him, staring at the floor, working his hands, chewing on his lower lip as he gently rocks back and forth. Obviously, he's been keeping vigil for the past hour. I make it to the bench beside him before he has time to try to get to his feet. Everything went well, I say, but already I can see he's searching my eyes for the caveat. I tell him exactly what we found about how we deflated the stomach and fixed it in place to prevent it from twisting in the future. I tell him about the spleen and how Sage will be absolutely fine without it. He hangs on every word, every intonation, reading more in the expressions on my face than the words falling from my mouth. I feel like he can hear, but he is not listening because he knows I am keeping something back. My biggest concern is the stomach wall and whether it will live or die. There's no way to know for sure. I had to make a judgment call, difficult one, but one that I believe is correct. The next 24 hours will be critical. He lets out a deep breath, hanging his head. He has allowed himself to hope, flooded by the relief that Sage is alive and still in the fight. And in doing so, a levee inside him has burst. Emotional and physical exhaustion are taking their toll. He looks like he may collapse. You need to get home and get some rest. Do you have to drive all the way back to the Cape? I noticed on Sage's record and address in Orleans, Cape Cod, at least an hour and a half drive given the wintry conditions. My daughter offered to put me up. She lives in Wellesley. Great, I say. Let's give her a wake-up call and let her know you'll be on your way. Might be better if you take a cab. Sage and I need you in good shape for visiting hours later today. He smiles, more with his eyes than his lips, nodding his understanding that he must be patient. I make sure we have his daughter's phone number and Sage's computer record, promising to call if anything changes as we part company. As I watch him go, my mind silences a tumult of ugly, undisclosed statistics. Mortality rates for DV can be as high as 60%, and factors associated with a higher chance of death include abnormal heart rhythms, extremely high pulse rates, the need to cut out part of the stomach, and the removal of the spleen. In short, Sage has checked off almost every negative prognostic factor for survival, and yet I still decided to give her the benefit of my doubt. Should I have been more blunt, more cynical, my synopsis of the surgery stacking the odds against success? Should I have used the word die more often, more emphatically? Not even if I had. Who would have been the beneficiary? Not Mr. Hartman, and certainly not poor old Sage. Sometimes early on in our careers, veterinarians tend to err on the side of caution when looking into their clinical crystal ball, seeking the safe refuge of a negative prognosis. If an animal died, the outcome was sadly inevitable. If the animal lives, the doctors worked a miracle. I made a huge decision, either a moment of flitting genius or enduring miscalculation. And like it or not, a stranger and his best friend are coming along for the ride. It is too late now. I may wonder if I have taken my final look at a stomach that should never have seen the light of day, but the verdict is already in. I just hope I read the decision correctly. Sentenced to life and not death by lethal injection. And that's the conclusion of our first chapter in Tell Me Where It Hurts. Okay, we have, let's see, we have about 7 minutes left. So from Catster Magazine, New Catitude, Mind and Body by Rita Reimers wrote the article. She has devoted her entire life to cats, and she's a founding owner of JF Cats, a feline health and wellness company. JF Cats has been providing cat behavior services and cats-only pet sitting for the last 15 years. Okay, it's not jealousy, it's rivalry. Another morning, I was peacefully lying in bed, waking up with my sweet Gigi kitty girl curled up beside me. We were both very comfy as we fell back to sleep for a few last moments, that is, until Pinky tried to join our cuddle. Suddenly, the normally sweet Gigi leaned over and gave Pinky a couple of very hard smacks on the head, letting her know that I was hers at that moment. She had no intention of sharing. Poor Pinky was stunned as she slowly slinked away. Do cats get jealous? This experience could be interpreted as jealousy for my attention, although that is putting the cat's behavior in human terms. In the cat world, is it really jealousy that Gigi was feeling, or was it something else altogether? As we know, cats are creatures of predictability and habit. They prefer a stable environment without a lot of changes and challenges, and they prefer to claim certain toys, places, and spaces in their home for their very own. Things they claim include you and your attention, too. What we think of as jealousy is actually cats rivaling one another for the same things. In nature, what drives cats to rival one another is scarce resources such as food and clean water. Male cats will run off other males to keep the resources, food, water, shelter, and female cats to themselves. Females keep their territory even smaller as they would in nature if they were raising kittens. The kitten nest becomes their domain, and unless one is part of the colony, they are not inclined to share their space. It's not jealousy, but competition for finite resources. Of course, our spoiled indoor kitties are not competing out in nature. However, their instincts to be protective, of resources is deeply ingrained in how cats behave. Even when living indoors with access to a seemingly endless supply of food, water, and cozy places to sleep, some cats just don't want to share their abundance. It's a throwback to nature's scarcity. As I mentioned, you are one of their primary resources, and at times they do not wish to share you with other cats. Consequently, the behavior we term as jealousy, but is actually rivalry for territory and resources, will occur from time to time. How to handle rivalries. The easiest way to handle rivalry is to ensure there is plenty of everything to go around. Scarcity and lack of anything can cause fighting and anxiety in your cats, so know what your particular cats need. Plenty of food, fresh water, clean litter boxes, and cozy napping spots are a good place to start. If you live in a small apartment and space is tight, add cat trees and shelving to give your cats more vertical spaces to claim as their own. Lots of cozy nooks and bedding will help too. Perhaps one of the most important resources cats need is quality time with you. This can be a challenge when you have multiple cats, but it's important to give each cat some one-on-one time with you, as well as group play time with one another. Attention giving can be as simple as sitting on the sofa with a cat or two next to you while you pet them both, or what I am doing right now, writing with one cat on my lap, that's Peanut Butter, and one cat watching as I type on my laptop, that's Pumpkin. Of course, I pause for occasional head scratches and kisses while I am writing, so they get my attention. Whether you call it jealousy or rivalry, understanding what drives your cats to behave in certain ways and which situations in your household may evoke rivalrous feelings gets you one step closer to keeping it at bay. Avoiding situations that may instigate kitty feelings of competition is one of the keys to achieving lasting harmony in your multi-cat household. And now a little sidebar here, signs of rivalry, fighting. Disagreements that are as simple as glaring at one another can escalate into vocalization, slapping, and chasing. Usually this is harmless if your cats get along well at other times. Hiding. A cat feeling displaced by the actions of a more dominant cat may hide after being challenged for resources. Scolding. My tiny three-legged cat, Smoochie, will scold my big boy cats if they try to join us on the sofa when she isn't willing to share and they back down as soon as she chatters at them. Eliminating in inappropriate places. A cat feeling extreme anxiety over resource rivalry may start eliminating outside the litter box, especially if you have a bully cat who likes to guard the box and not let other cats use it in peace. Okay, so that's the end of that article, and now we have time for a few small things from the Obsessions of Dogster magazine. New drug shows promise for dog dementia. An estimated 40% of senior dogs 12 or older will develop some level of canine cognitive dysfunction, also known as canine dementia. A pilot clinical trial conducted for dogs with CCD looked at the drug ropsalazine. That's ropsalazine, ropsalazine, which is a candidate for treating human Alzheimer's patients. According to the drug's manufacturer, South Korea-based GNT Pharma, ropsalazine showed efficacy in canine dementia patients returning to normal cognitive function and daily activity after 8 weeks of treatment. Okay, we also have Pets for Elderly Foundation. Everyone needs love and companionship, and that's why the late Avram Katz founded Pets for the Elderly Foundation in 1992. His vision was to provide companionship to senior citizens through pet ownership while saving the lives of companion animals in shelters. PFE is currently the only national organization matching shelter animals with senior citizens, and this nonprofit organization hit a milestone this year, reaching more than 80,000 national pet and senior matches since the organization went national in 2002. PFE pays a portion of the fees to participating shelters throughout the United States for senior citizens age 60 and over who adopt a dog or cat from a participating shelter, including pre-adoption veterinary exams and spay-neuter, if those are part of the adoption fee. So far, there are 56 participating shelters in 35 states with the hopes of expanding to having a shelter in every state in 2019. Patricia Smith recently adopted her puppy, Brady, with PFE's help. A widowed, retired middle school teacher, she was looking for a new canine companion after her dog, Chloe, passed away. She wasn't really considering a puppy, but when she saw Brady, then called Joe at the shelter, she couldn't resist, and she brought him home that same day. She says that Brady is a loving little guy who follows her everywhere. When she took him to a puppy socialization class offered by the Humane Society, he ended up being the star of the class. Patricia's looking forward to many rewarding years with her new buddy. She points out that he's really full of energy, so he'll definitely keep her young. For more information, visit petsfortheelderly.org. And with that little segment on Pets for the Elderly Foundation, I'm completely out of time. So until next week, this is Irene Friedman, as always, reminding you, please spay and neuter your cats and dogs. Thank you for tuning in and listening. And to everyone out there, have a great day and a great week. Bye, everyone.